I'm Jesse P.S., and I'm the host of the Pod Awful Podcast. We're a comedy show where crazy shit happens. On my show, my girlfriend has called in to break up with me. I've been arrested live, and the Secret Service actually investigated me over something I said in the show. We've had such crazy guests as...
Mike Kaplan.
Hello, Jesse. This is Andrew W.K.
Jackie Cation.
This is Gail Gilligan. Jesse, how are you?
And here are some of the glowing reviews we've received.
Another crass amateur hour podcast. Not for me, probably not for you either. This podcast once held my mother down and spit in her mouth.
We are Pod Awful. We are live every Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time over at podawful.tv, and you can check out our podcast anytime at podawful.com. We are, of course, a part of the Pod Awful channel, podcast network. Please check out all the shows over at podawful.net. And until you check us out, have an awful day.
Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
To pull off a job no one would ever dare, you need a team no one would ever believe. They did more to the syndicate in 27 minutes than anyone else ever did in 27 years. Paramount Pictures presents Hit, starring Billy Dee Williams as Nick, a top cop on the run. His hit team came in all sizes, all colors, and all probes. When they hit, they hurt. The target, 9 syndicate kings. Time limit, 27 minutes to hit. Then split. Hit. Starring Billy Dee Williams and Richard Pryor in Panavision and Technicolor. Rated R. Under 17, not admitted without parent.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is Mr. Rob St. Mary.
Warning, this podcast is more addictive than heroin.
Also along for the ride this week is Mr. Daniel Kramer.
It's good to be here.
This week we're looking at the 1973 action film Hit. The film stars Billy Dee Williams as federal agent Nick Allen. When Nick's sister takes a hot shot, he goes on the warpath for the people that put the smack on the streets. Rather than dealing with the two-bit hustlers and thugs, Nick takes it all the way to the source, making a real French connection with a group of drug kingpins in Marseille. Nick puts together a team of oddball assassins, including Richard Pryor, as Mike Wilmer, a former frogman. Daniel, as our guest co-host this week, I will start with you. When did you first see Hit, and what were your thoughts?
Well, I actually first saw Hit on a pan and scan VHS. I think I might have been early 20s, so I think I was in college when I saw it, and there was like a little shop on South Street in Philly that had a copy. The first time I tried to watch it, I really couldn't get through it. At the time I first tried to watch it, I didn't realize that I was missing probably about half the actual picture, and I thought that John Alonzo's camera work on it was rather, you know, subpar, and I just kind of moved on from there. I was really hooked to buy it because I was a fan of Sydney's Ipcress file, and I'd seen Naked Runner and Appaloosa, all of them actually in the video pan scan format. But I wasn't really impressed with a lot of other John Lundgren. I'm a very film snobby kind of guy when it comes to how a film looks, but then again, I saw it later when the DVD came out in 2012, and it was like I was seeing it for the very first time, and I was immediately very impressed with just how the film feels like it's written in a kind of jazz language, where it's, you know, you have character, you have the actors kind of riffing off each other, and it feels, and the whole production feels very run and gun. But at the same time, it's this epic kind of thing, and it's, I mean, actually, it's funny because when I told when Sydney Fury came for the taping sessions for the book I'm doing on him, he came to New York twice, and the first time he came to New York, I guess it was like around this time last year, I told him like, yeah, you should really check out Hit, and he had no idea that the film was as long as it was. He had no memory of it being 2 hours and 15 minutes long. when I told him, he's like, how did we get away with that? How did Paramount let us get away with a 2-hour, 15-minute genre picture about just this kind of ragtag band of you know, misfit toys out to take it to the source and you know, get rid of the Marseille, you know, drug ring and everything. So I wish I had this on tape, because when he was seeing it again for the first time in 40 years, he kept on saying, wow, wow, I can't believe I got away. Wow, look at that shot. Wow. And then, like, he got back to L.A. and ran the film. And he said, you know, if I get nothing else out of doing this book with you, I will have gotten Hit back again. I mean, I was just shocked at how different the experience was for me seeing it on this kind of crappy VHS that was released in the early 90s. Even though I'm an inveterate VHS collector and not, I have thousands upon thousands of VHS tapes, but seeing it finally, like, full screen, or rather widescreen, you know, 2:3:5 aspect ratio, it was really oddly revelatory for me, and actually was the spur behind my actually saying, like, so someone needs to do a book about Sidney Fury and his work and his life and all this kind of stuff. So that's really where it began. That and seeing another film he made called Sheila Levine is Dead and Living in New York in widescreen. Both were kind of experiences where I was like, oh, this is a very ballsy kind of approach to widescreen composition, visual filmmaking, and I saw themes emerging and reemerging throughout all his work.
As for Hit, for me, I didn't even know that this film existed, to be quite honest. I hadn't seen it before Mike sent it to me to take a look at for the show, and was kind of amazed, actually, when I was watching it, that Billy Dee Williams was the lead. And I had to go back and kind of look and go, oh, yeah, that's right. He actually had quite a decent career in the early 70s and was a leading man before he became Lando Calrissian, which is, you know, my first memory of him was Star Wars. So it's an interesting film to watch, and especially watching it against, like you had mentioned in the opening, sort of the French connection. To me, it seems that it has a similar DNA to the Friedkin film. And then also at the same time, another thing I think is interesting about it is it has this broad cast, it has this broad ethnic cast, and it has subtitled sections because there's parts of it that are in French. And it doesn't feel like a blaxploitation film of that era. It seems like this film was written for whatever cast, and it just happened that the studio gave Fury, I guess, the okay to go, yes, you can have Billy Dee Williams as your lead. The poster art seems a little much in the flavor of the blaxploitation films of the era in the early 1950s, but in terms of the actual production of the film and the style of the film, it is definitely not a blaxploitation film in that way.
When the film first was released, the critics were really in a muddle as to how, whether or not they should categorize it as a blaxploitation product. And even now today, there's this kind of conundrum that presents itself with people seeing it in today's light, where it's just like, does this really fit in to within the confines of a genre that is very above board and out there when it comes to, like, oh, a blaxploitation genre, because it will present itself as such. A lot of the critics at the time, I have a whole paragraph in the book about, you know, the one about the critical reception of the film. One person called it an oddity. Charles Champlin from the LA Times, he wrote that it was told with energy and dash, but also was among the first of the people to approach the fact that really the onus was upon the audience to prove that it was a work independent of the whole blaxploitation genre. And he kind of pointed out the fact that, you know, this is probably Paramount probably doesn't know what to do with this film, or how to market it, or how to, you know, kind of really hook into the niche that the market that this film would best work within. So it's a really, it's an odd duck in that regard. And as to your comment about Billy Dee being the star of the film, he had done Brian's Song and he auditioned for the role of, Lewis McKay in Lady Sings the Blues. He was up against Paul Winfield. There was a kind of inner struggle between Berry Gordy and Sidney as to who would play, Lewis McKay. Sidney wanted Paul Winfield and Berry Gordy wanted Billy Dee. And the interesting thing is that the way that Barry convinced him is, like, don't you want to give is an exact quote, as I actually, is like, he said, "Don't you want to give little black girls their Clark Gable? Don't you want to give them a matinee idol and not just another good actor?" Because I guess his audition for Lady was terrible, according to all sources, including Barry Gordy and Shelley Berger, who handled Diana and a lot of the Motown people and Sydney. And that's one of the reasons why he didn't want to cast him in the role. So when he fared well, and I mean, Lady is a lot of improv in that film. I mean, almost every scene, there's some form of the actresses riffing off of each other and just kind of going and seeing where it takes them, even though it was, I think, very well directed to kind of accomplish a goal for each scene. But Hit is very much in that flavor. So, and you will notice that there are a lot of people who were involved with Lady that were also involved with Hit. John Alonso is carried over as DP. Sydney Melton, who was in Lady Sings the Blues, also carried over playing the the other half of the old Jewish couple who gets recruited as part of the gang. Pryor is carried over, so it was kind of like, so as Sydney said, it was the most natural thing in the world when he brought up the idea to Alan Trussman. It's like, this is an idea I have, and write it, you know. So he said it was the most natural thing in the world to carry over the people, a lot of the people who had worked on Lady, to be in a part of Hit. So that's kind of how Billy Dee, and there was actually a Time article written about him at the time. It was called The Black Gable. So they were really harping on him and really trying to build him up as the matinee idol of the kind of, you know, black American crowd at the time. So it was really his first major, you know, starring role beyond Lady and beyond Brian's Song. And it was really his chance to shine. And it didn't, I mean, the critics at the time, as I said, a lot of them didn't know what to make of it. And if they didn't totally dismiss it, it was kind of like a shrug in a way. So thus he gives a really famous supporting role in a great franchise like Star Wars, which has made him a lot of money over the years, no doubt. But yeah, it was kind of his opportunity to prove himself as a leading man who is front and center in pretty much every scene except for the French, which I was grateful to see were subtitled in the original language, because you hate French actors when they talk American like this, and you're forced to, you know. There are many things in the film that I'm very intrigued, choices made that I'm intrigued by, I guess.
For me, I remember seeing this one on the video shelf very often, and it had that really cheesy cover. I'm sure it's the one that you saw, yeah. Daniel, with the Billy Dee holding the bazooka and the big explosion behind him and everything. And I think had I rented this back then, expecting a blaxploitation picture, I would have been really kind of cheesed off when it came to this. It reminds me of when a friend of mine went and watched Detroit 9000 and thought it was going to be a blaxploitation film. And obviously, you know, Rob and I talked about that is not blaxploitation. This one kind of starts in that vein as far as starting off in the ghetto, and you've got the... Right. The sister and her drug dealer boyfriend, and just it kind of has those trappings. But I think within like 10 minutes, we're already breaking from that and kind of going into this whole wide world of drugs and government agencies and all this kind of stuff. And it's kind of nice that it does. It's nice that it has this kind of bigger world view. It reminded me a little bit of The Split, where we had Jim Brown playing Parker in that, and it really didn't matter. I mean, they kind of tailored that a little bit more for Brown and made his character, McLean, I think it was, made him more black, but really they don't seem to care if it's Billy Dee and Richard Pryor playing these roles or not, especially, I mean, just their names like Mike and Nick. It's just like, yeah, these aren't like what I would think of as early 70s black guy names kind of thing. But it's kind of cool that they don't care and that they're just, it's almost like race neutral when they're playing this. But, and that can be good, that can be bad. But for me, I was like, it's like, hey, these are two ass kicking guys and I'm really glad to see them. And they're not making a big deal about stuff. And there's not like this kind of a problem when it comes to the black guy who's, you know, kind of working on this relationship with this white woman. It's just, you know, they don't really enter into that conversation at all. And, you know, for better or worse, I thought it really kind of worked.
And also tonally, the way that it's put together, especially that opening, is very sort of on the street, neo-realist kind of docudrama kind of thing. Because when you watch it the first time and you put it in, I don't even think you get credits on the front. It's just this guy and the girl, and they're in the car, and then they get the heroin, and then they do the drugs, and she ODs, and it's very, it's shot very sort of almost documentary-like, and things really sort of maintain that way. It really has this sort of fly-on-the-wall feel. There's not a lot of really, there's not a lot of flash to it in that way. It's really kind of stripped down and very easy to take in that way.
You talking about that really reminds me of the scene where Billy Dee Williams' character is talking to his friend who's on the police force. Billy Dee's on a government force. They never really say what it is, you know, if it's CIA, FBI, which is kind of nice that they don't have to label it. But he's talking to his friend who's a cop and who's really into hamburgers. And then you see the cop going down and busting this guy. And the way that they shoot it is all through this like really long lens zooming in. And you just hear the audio from forever away. Like you can overhear this conversation. And I like that kind of, you know, the use of the zoom lens. You're right. There is this kind of neorealism type thing that they're doing in this.
Right. And actually there was another similar film that was released a month before Hit that was a blaxploitation treatment of this very, almost the very same story. It was called Goings War, which was directed by Ossie Davis. At the time, there were a couple comparisons made between those two films. I mean, Gordon's War is very, you know, very urban. It doesn't really leave the confines of this kind of, Harlem ghetto kind of backdrop. Most of the characters in that film are black, and they're trying to achieve the downfall of the higher ups within the kind of drug trade. In that sense, and actually, Gordon's War beat Hit to theaters. Gordon's War came out in August of 1973, and Hit came out in September of 1973. So they came out like just within a month of each other. So it's interesting when you kind of juxtapose the two films, Gordon's War and Hit, and seeing that Hit begins with this kind of, as you're saying, you know, stripped down elliptical cutting quality, where it's cutting between kind of the masters and the servants in between Marseille and Washington D.C. And also, what's very interesting, it's a very small thing, and actually, they're never like title cards to establish where we are at any point in the film. I mean, we jump from Dick Harbor in Washington to Los Angeles to, I think one point is we're in Chicago, and then another point we're in Washington, D.C., and then we're in Marseille. But he uses this kind of trope of license plates a great deal, and that this kind of a motif that gets established. So it becomes this kind of very efficient thing of taking us from one place to another, and you know, it's the very nature of the film being kind of, you know, a lot of shots were grabbed. I talked to many of the people involved in the production, including Billy Dee and including Ray Fredrickson, who is the executive producer of the film, who also worked on a lot of movies like Godfather and a couple other Sidney's films. But they often talk about the fact that shots were just grabbed, and they had no permits for a lot of what they were shooting. And I think audiences now, I've read recent reviews and write-ups, including one, and there's a new bio of Richard Pryor, where the writers of the book really talk up, in one paragraph, talk up Hit, saying like, you have to find the audience it deserves, and you know, and it's really a lot of interesting stuff going on and everything. So I think it's getting, in a sense, a kind of quiet reappraisal. There are like things that are at odds with each other that make it very kind of a pleasing confluence of many things happening at once in the film, which is what really intrigues me as the person writing about it in this book.
I'm a big fan of this whole idea of getting the team together, and I love movies kind of like the Dirty Dozen does it pretty quickly, right. But there are other films where, you know, you spend half the film getting the team together, and this is along those lines. This is more of an Ocean's 11 kind of thing. And really, as I was watching it, I was reminded a lot of a heist film, even though it doesn't end up being a heist that they're going after. But I really kind of like that they take the time to introduce each one of these characters, and that they don't give you really these kind of easy answers when it comes to, well, I think you should join this team because this happened and this happened and this other thing happened, and that's exactly why you should join us. You know, there's not that kind of real laying out of the cards. You know, they really kind of play it close to the vest when it comes to the way that we're learning little bits about each of these characters. And I even like the way that the order that they pick up these characters in. And there are some where you know more that, about them than the others. I would say the Richard Pryor character, you get to know a little bit more than some of the other ones. The prostitute character, you learn a little bit more about her. There's the one guy who's kind of the assassin-y kind of guy, white guy. Don't really learn a whole lot about him, but he ends up being kind of a dick anyway, which is okay. But I love that kind of way that they pace this thing out.
Actually, in an early chapter title, when originally in a very early chapter of the book, each film had each important film had its own chapter title, which my editor took me to task for. But the chapter title of the chapter on Hit originally was called The Dirty Half Dozen. because it is very much in line with the kind of recruitment phase of the whole operation, and I mean the whole enterprise is kind of implausible in its way, but I don't really care about the. I mean, I'm able to suspend the disbelief because it's a lot of the kind of outrageous recruitment of the old couple, Sid Melton and Janet Brand, who would ironically go on to play the parents of Sheila Levine, and Sheila Levine is dead living in New York City, yet another carryover from a previous Fury film, his next film, they were also cast as the same kind of couple. I mean, there was no character change at all. They just changed the names, and it's the same people, essentially. Yeah, I mean, I don't know, just the whole recruitment phase, it is very much in the mode of the kind of classic Motley Crue genre picture of the time, I guess.
I like the old couple. I think the old couple's great because I don't think that it's expressed exactly what their background is, but I got the feeling through the conversation that they were maybe former resistance people during World War II when it came to the Jews in Germany and maybe France or something. It was just kind of interesting that they get recruited for their expertise because they had some sort of previous like anti-government training a long time ago.
One of my favorite moments is such a little moment, but it's so charming. I find it. It's when the old couple they're kind of practicing their running. They're trying to get within a certain time, being timed by Billy Dee, and they're huffing and puffing. Billy Dee says he calls the old lady. He calls Janet Brand's character Bubula, I think, or Mumula. And I don't know, I just found that so charming. And I don't know, it is a kind of, because what's interesting is that Sidney was the first director in line to direct The Godfather the year before. Talking to Al Ruddy, who produced The Godfather and had produced Little Foss and Big Halsey, they brought that film 8 days under schedule because, you know, Sidney kind of patented a multi-camera operation, which hadn't been used in a major Hollywood picture before. So as a present to Al Ruddy for bringing in Little Foss and Big Halsey on time, they gave him The Godfather to produce, and he requested that Sidney direct the film. Of course, there were other directors who were interviewed, including Arthur Penn and everything, but Al Ruddy was really adamant about Sidney Fury, and ultimately Coppola's Italian heritage won the day. But what's interesting about Hit is that it's like Fury is fashioning his own kind of crime family, in a sense. There's even a kind of inside joke towards the end of the film where Sid Melton's character is in a movie theater in Marseille, and playing on the screen is I think it's Il Padrino, which is the overseas Godfather. So you see the Godfather logo on the movie screen and the movie within the movie, and we hear Lalo Schifrin's percussion main title theme playing over it. So it's kind of I don't know. I always figure that as kind of like a wink, wink to himself. They passed me up on Godfather. Okay, I'll make my own crime family, and here we go. Here's them, and play Dante Delicto, just kind of carrying out all these hits, for themselves, and just kind of take it. But because the core group does become very familial to me, it seems like. And the night before they are about to carry out their tasks, we catch each of them, you know, kind of in alone moments. You know, there's an old couple, they're in bed together and they're sharing a kind of moment. And there's a guy ordering a French hamburger, the Warren Kammerling's character ordering a French hamburger, and then there's Paul Hampton with a prostitute. And then, you know, I mean, at that point, what I love about it is that you really somewhat, even though Paul Hampton is a kind of a-hole or develops into that, as we find out, you know, he doesn't really betray anyone in the group, but you really feel that you've been brought away in the film where they feel like a core familial group of contracted killers. And it is, in a sense, and I can't help but think that, you know, Sidney laughing in the, while he was cutting the film, he's like in the editing room, and they put in this kind of Godfather joke you know, towards the end of the film, and a very kind of poorly composited image of the Godfather title screen. And I can just imagine him like just laughing and saying, and kind of laughing at to himself that it was kind of an inside joke. He had the opportunity to kind of do it for himself and his own narrative that wasn't engineered by, and according to him, Paramount just kind of let him do this very under the radar type of film. No one was checking in really with the crew or the cast and crew. It was just kind of like, you know, it was a very freeing kind of on set experience, being allowed to do this kind of under the radar, and the movie just kind of was released. It had no kind of fanfare, nothing really to speak of in the promotional department. Even I think the poster is pretty badass. But you know, that's kind of my theory is that you know, he was fashioning the film as a kind of his take on the cinematic crime family, in a sense. Yeah, I don't know if you guys feel that way at all, but
yeah, it was funny. As I was watching it, I was saying to myself, you know, oh, this is like the killing of the heads of the five families. And then when he goes into the movie theater and that Paramount logo comes up, I was just like, is this what I think it is? So that was a nice little nod there going on. And I do like the way that they kind of clean up everything at the end, and just that, you know, you're kind of keeping track. You're like, okay, they have nine people that they're going after here. Now, how many people have they gotten so far, and who's going to be this guy? And, you know, it's not this kind of outrageous, the deaths aren't too crazy. They all seem to kind of make sense. I mean, there is that kind of outrageousness as far as this group of Americans going over to France and taking care of these drug families and all that. One of the things that I don't want to forget to talk about is the way that Nick kind of is on the inside. The Billy Dee Williams character is an insider at first as a government agent, and then quickly goes on the outside. He is quickly kind of disavowed by the people that he's working for, to the point where two of the guys that he's working with are constantly coming after him and trying to stop him, to the point of trying to put a bullet in him, which I kind of like that way that he's been ostracized and kind of doing his own thing. I mean, taking the law into his own hands, but in the best way possible. And he's not like this kind of vigilante, Dirty Harry-ish kind of stereotype. He's very, very calm about the whole thing. And he's very, very well planned when it comes to exactly how he's going to do this. I mean, the guy's got a list, you know, and you know, he's very organized when he's got a list.
He's got that long kind of, index of you know, vulnerable people who can be made vulnerable by blackmail most of the time. But it's also interesting. I wanted to quickly mention that Sight and Sound reviewed the DVD of the film, and it was actually a very nice review, and it was a nice kind of reappraisal of the film after these decades. But the author called attention to, as you said, the kind of echo of the ending movement of The Godfather, in which all these kind of assassination scenarios are kind of cut against each other. But yeah, I mean, it's the Nick Allen character is very, he's never as sympathetic as one would expect him to be. He can be a downright probably bastard at times, the way that he kind of manipulates the people involved into doing his will. And to kind of carrying out these tasks, and you know, the way that he, you know, occasional scenes where, you know, we see him almost one-track mindedly and shamelessly just kind of rearranging the whole scenario to, you know, to suit his needs and his, but the whole thing with Zooey Hall and I'm forgetting the other guy's name, but the two Fed agents, the two kind of bumbling guys who are put on his tail, that is a kind of amusing side, you know, subplot. And I knew Zoe Hall from, you know, Fortune in Men's Eyes, the adaptation of the MGM adaptation of the play that was made in Canada. So it was interesting seeing him, not as a kind of, gay prisoner in this, you know, Canadian, you know, penitentiary, but where we're actually seeing him as a kind of bumbling character next to, overlooking the other guy's name. But yeah, this, it's kind of seeing that. I mean, the whole movie doesn't, it takes its time to play out, and Sydney has told me that Argyle Nelson, the editor, and I were on the picture for 7 or 8 months versus my normal 5 months or 6 months at most. And he said, I'm happy it didn't get swallowed up by the guys at Paramount saying, speed it up, because it could have been, you know, butchered if they didn't allow the movie to breathe. And the whole, and all these scenes that just kind of, they play out longer than we're used to seeing them play out a lot of the time, including the kind of bumbling feds who were after him. So it's, so seeing a kind of a genre piece that's as unusually paced as this film is really an anomaly, in my opinion. And you know, it's, so there are, you know, like I said, a lot of things happening that people would probably take notice of if they saw it more than it is out there now, I think. Which I think now that it's out on Blu-ray and on DVD again, it's an opportunity. I'm not sure how many people, and because they use the same exact bazooka cover with the explosion in the background, as opposed to the original poster art, which would have been great for the cover. But yeah, they use that kind of, they essentially use a VHS cover for this new release from all the films, which purchased a lot of Paramount's back catalog titles. How many people will pick it up based on the cover? But yeah, it does present a kind of, to me, a hidden gem, even though, you know, it's, people will kind of might call it quaint or whatever. And I know that Tarantino, as I mentioned, my original article that I wrote about Sydney, and I wrote it in May 2012. I know that Tarantino owns a print of the film and is very fond of it. I guess you could ask what prints doesn't he own at this point, but, and what 70s genre picture doesn't he like? But yeah, I know that I've read he's said some very nice things about how unusual Hit is, and you can kind of see it emerge in the kind of talky nature of Pulp Fiction and a lot of the canonical Tarantino titles, because there's a lot of talk and a lot of kind of strange pacing devices that lead up to payoffs, like actual action genre payoff scenes. That's kind of sort of influenced in a sense, in that, you know, it takes a lot to build up to a payoff in any given, you know, action set piece, I guess, which is another interesting aspect of the film, I think.
Yeah, the transfer is beautiful, but I really don't like that Olive doesn't do any kind of special things when it comes to the films. I mean, these are right there with the kind of Warner Archives stripped down kind of stuff, and it feels a little like they're cheating sometimes. I mean, especially we covered Invasion of the Body Snatchers a few months ago, and seeing that on Olive's DVD or Blu-ray release, it was just like, really? You know, nothing, not even a freaking preview, not a commentary, not a documentary. I mean, I don't know how much promotional material Hit might have had, but at least have, you know, the radio spot or a preview or anything. But yeah, that was, it's tough. I like that they're doing this stuff, but at the same time, it's like, come on, guys, just put a little bit more effort into this. You know, go ahead and at least give me the old poster image on the back or as an insert on the inside or something. But yeah, it was nice to see it in the widescreen version, at least, and it did look absolutely gorgeous. And you're right, there are a lot of kind of Tarantino-isms in there, especially the whole thing with the hamburger. I could definitely see that kind of being an influence.
Yeah, and it's funny. I mean, I think oftentimes in terms of commentary tracks, you know, Sydney has done a commentary track for It Chris, the two Cliff Richard movies he's done in the early 60s in England. I think for commentary, and he also did a commentary track for Lady Sings the Blues, but he's been kind of out of the loop when it comes to, I know that they've approached him for couple other things, and he's very, as I think he told me on the phone, he's a very forward kind of thinker, and doesn't like looking back. It was kind of a chore in a sense to finally get him hooked into doing the book. And you know, I'll get into this later. It's largely thanks to his friend Paul Lynch, who directed Prom Night, that the book is finally coming into reality. Boys and Company C, which came out on DVD a couple years ago, features a commentary track by Andrew Stevens. When I told Sydney that, it's funny, and he's like, Boys and Company C is now. I was like, no, it's out. He's like, it's out? Who put it out? And like, Hen Street Video. I didn't hear about that. And he was like, yeah, and they had Andrew Stevens doing a commentary. He's like, why didn't they call me to do a commentary? Because that's like, oh, and the film that he's one of the two films that he's the proudest of, I think he told me. But he got slightly bent out of shape. He was like, why didn't they call me to do the Boys and Company C commentary track? But and now he would have done the hit commentary. He wouldn't have done it before I told him to see it again. Kind of kept himself more out of the limelight than I think a lot of directors might have for, I mean, particularly for features on DVDs, particularly considering the breadth and depth of the sheer number of films he's done. I mean, Entity, there's no kind of commentary. There's kind of a little thing on Doris Byther, the real-life lady who was ghost-raped. But other than that, you know, there's really nothing that he's done in terms of, DVD, even though I'd love to see a commentary track for The Leather Boys, which is my favorite film of his. But it's an out-of-print kino disc that's been out of print for like 6 or 7 years now. The fact that Chris Weil is out of print is a real amazing thing that I really can't believe. You have to go to Amazon and a used copy is like $35 or $40 or somewhere in that range.
So I want to take a break and play the interview that we did with Sydney Fury, just because, yeah, it is amazing. He's an amazing character. But before that, I do want you to tell the story that you were going to tell about the shooting of Hit.
The producer of the film was a guy named Harry Korshak, who was the son of Sidney Korshak, who was a notorious figure in Hollywood. I guess he was he was kind of a power broker at Paramount and had represented Jimmy Hoffa and a bunch of characters throughout. So it was his first film as producer. He wanted to get into the film business, and his father kind of orchestrated that. It's no mystery. So when they went to shoot part of the film in Washington D.C., they were just kind of grabbing things, they were just little like kind of B-roll shots of and when they got back to their hotel that night, the Teamsters were there waiting for them and said that, oh, we know you guys are shooting. We'll meet you here tomorrow at 8 a.m. And they were very kind of, they said, okay, we'll meet you. You don't meet us. You meet us at our time, and we're going to work with you and everything. I said, well, no, we're not shooting. We're just looking at locations. So no. We know you're shooting. We'll meet you here in the lobby tomorrow and blah, 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 blah. So Gray Fredrickson, who told me this story, looked at Harry Korshak and Sydney and said, hey, guys, we're screwed. We don't have enough money to pay. This is a little low-budget, second unit kind of operation. We don't have money to pay Teamsters or anything like that. We're done. Gray said, Harry, can you call your father and maybe he can do something? The very next morning, these Teamsters show up in the hotel, meek as lambs, and they said, oh, we are sorry. We had no idea who you guys were. Hey, listen, anything you want, you got it. You have a police escort out there. You have trucks. You have whatever you want. It's on the house. And Fredrickson and Sidney are like, damn, Harry, your dad's got some juice. And he goes, yeah, it's good to have a powerful father every now and then. It comes in handy. But kind of, is in the whole spirit of the fact that the film, they were just, as I said, grabbing things a lot of the time and just kind of making things happen last minute. And Sidney would see locations and say, like, okay, let's grab a shot here. As he would do in other films like Foss and Aldi, crew members recall that they'd be on their way, and then he'd say, okay, stop the caravan. We're going to do the scene right here. There's a kind of element of live dangerousness about him that he just kind of sat down and say, we're going to do it right here, and this is the way it's going to be. But it was very much in that flavor, even though the lady wasn't so much in that, even though there was a lot of improv, but it was kind of use amazing. Actually, one critic said that at the time that it seems like the film was made up as it goes along to suit the locations that were that are used in the background. I don't know. I think it adds to the charm of the whole affair. But anyway.
All right, we are going to take a break and play an interview with Sydney Fury, and I want to apologize in advance for the sound quality of this one, folks. Hopefully you can stick with it, because I think it's definitely worth it.
There are 12 miles of bad road, and now they have a microphone and their own show. It's the Daily Grindhouse Podcast, the official podcast of DailyGrindhouse.com. Starring G.
You tell her that you sent you here. How sorry I am, I can no longer be her friend.
And the man called Perry.
I'm the one that killed Munch and whooped Tuesday and put Wims in the hospital. Called up Burrs did a tell five did not the Burrs, Sarah Jones son.
Reviewing the hits and the hidden from the world of exploitation, cinema, and beyond. Featuring exclusive cast and crew interviews. Past guests include John Carpenter, Robert Forster, Brian Trenchard-Smith, but still no Steve Guttenberg.
We'll get him someday. We promise. I mean,
we promise. The Daily Grindhouse Podcast, available on iTunes, Stitcher Smart Radio, Podomatic, and of course at dailygrindhouse.com/podcasts. The Daily Grindhouse Podcast, tough films for the rough crowd.
Got the goddamn message? Let's go to work.
If you listen to Proudly Resents, the cult movie podcast, you would know how to properly crush a head.
But let's say you want to crush a head like Toxic Avenger or the famous full head crushing scene. You take a cantaloupe, carve out the inside, then you load what we call loading the cantaloupe. We used to put in hamburger mixed with cranberry sauce, but now because I'm a vegetarian, it's only cranberry and spaghetti and things that are not animal. Then you put a wig on the cantaloupe and paint a little happy face. Bingo.
That was Lloyd Kaufman from Troma Films. To hear more interviews and reviews, go to ProudlyResents.com or find Proudly Resents on iTunes and Stitcher.
It's the
Bye.
Quarterly Women's
Social Club.
It's not on my phone.
Well,
I'll
show
tell you that.
Afar.
It's not on fucking my phone.
Now, the ball was in
you
your court.
No, I fucking sent you a text back.
Yeah, but I never got it. What do you want me to tell you? I never got it.
You call to confirm.
God, aren't you tired of this NPR feel-good radio wishy-washy everyone learns something and feels great about it crap?
Not me. I get ones that want to fuck up their ass, and I like to do that.
What I present to you is chaos.
And I get ones who want to be slapped around a bit, and I do that too.
And you will laugh. It's a comedy show. It's a comedy show where you will actually laugh.
I would love to lick your pony vagina.
It's the Bi-Quarterly Women's Social Club.
All right, well, to be blunt with you, I'm thinking that we should contact the police because it sounds like you have some really nasty situation going on.
I'm sorry?
We want to pray that two people we don't like get cancer.
Why would you pray for someone to get cancer?
Because we don't like
them. So if you hate podcasts and you're sick of all the shit that's out there, listen to my show, the Bi-Quarterly Women's Social Club. I'm the host, Chris Wilding. Facebook.com/biquarterly or BQWSC.com, where you can find out everything about us, listen to episodes, and get our live show schedule. Hope to see you there. Seacrest out.
Have a good night, motherfucker.
How was it growing up in Toronto?
It was interesting. You know, it was a complete wasteland in the days of radio, right? But remember, before the internet, before television. So you really felt you were in Toronto. When you go to Toronto now, you feel like you're in the United States, right? It's like the whole world has changed because of the internet. There's no question. There are no hicks anymore. So that famous Variety headline, what was that? Hicks, sticks, Knicks, picks. So hicks in the sticks are going to see movies, right? But now there are no hits. They know everything. They know who's sleeping with who, who's in, who's out, what. You know, it's maybe that's good because you can't fool people as much now, I hope.
So how did a young boy from Toronto get into the movie business back in the day?
There it is. According to my mother, I was born in 33, so I'm 80. And in 1939, we were visiting the Niagara Falls, she said. And I do remember the movie. They took me to my first movie. It was MGM's Captain's Courageous. And she said that not long afterwards, I was six, I knew there was a director. How I knew, I don't know. But she said, I'm going to direct movies, which is interesting. But I guess six-year-old kids today all say they're going to make movies. And here's the joke. And they do. The tools are there. There were no tools then. 8mm, you know, 16. So I always wanted to do that because it was moving. Maybe it's because I was in Toronto, which on Sunday there were no movies. There were you could only have a drink in a hotel. Restaurants didn't serve booze. A beer, you'd go to a beer hall. It was like something out of another planet. And I think movies were an incredible escape from the dreariness and everything, you know. But I think movies just do that to people, as music then did in the next generation or two, you know. And it was surprising because there was no TV, no DVDs, nothing, right? You'd actually go to the movies, and what an event it was. Oh, my God, what an event. And you never get over it. It's an immaturity that you never, ever, ever get over. It's childlike fantasy. Just to get in the mood for this, I watched an old movie. Right before, I'm actually working on a script. I said, no, I'm not going to be working when I have to make the phone call. I will watch a movie and just get into the make-believe mood. But it's been a long time, and nothing has changed except I'm older. And the only thing that's changed is I have more energy. I have a lot of energy because why not, you know? I just don't want to be some old fart sitting around living in the past. So that's why, segue to Daniel's book, he couldn't reach me. He tried to. I said, I don't want to hear about a book. I cannot look into the past. I don't want it. I don't want to. I'm still trying to deal with the present, right, and make it meaningful. And then I guess we had a mutual friend through his mutual friend who had a friend, knew someone I knew, an actor, and they called me up and said, look, this is a rare bird. He makes his own movies. He went to film school. He was going to be a rabbi. He's just an amazing guy. And I had read on his blog something about me that an actor in my last film said, you've got to read this. And I knew he could write, and he could write well. So we had a phone call, and I said, okay, let's start it. And it's amazing. You know, it's been a great, great process. And the joy of it is you can at least go back and relive memorable experiences on movies because he wants to know all the goodies on the movie. I'm interested in talk who was doing who to what and how they were and all those things. Not so much about the movie itself because it's done. You know, the stuff you can't reshoot it, you can't remake it. It's an interesting road, and he's an, I don't know how well you know him, but he's an incredible person. And I say now is one of my closest friends. And what's interesting about it is I know how he feels about many of the movies, but I don't want to read any of the book until it comes out. I don't want to know where he criticizes some or others. I trust him, and it'll be honest. You know, that's the good part of it.
Real briefly, I wanted to ask you when, you know, how you initially made that jump to make A Dangerous Age.
How I did it was my parents, who were immigrants to Canada, wanted me to go to college. I had no desire for college. They offered nothing I wanted, right? I said, okay. I picked a school, which then was called Carnegie Institute of Technology in Pittsburgh, that had a drama department. And it offered a BFA, which means you only took film subjects with the odd in English, a psychology, history, it's one a semester or something. It was a professional school. So I conned them into sending me there, and I spent four great years studying the theater and enjoyed it. And actually, it was a playwriting major because directing majors had a hack, and I was much too embarrassed to get on a stage. And I think the playwriting was the best thing I ever did because structure is what movies are. And I came back to Toronto. I was 21, graduated, and went to see some people at CBC. That was Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, had TV. And that was about the only place you could knock on a door. There weren't any doors. And the guy said, we have nothing for you, but you have studied drama in the States, and we want to keep you in Canada, so I've got an idea. We need to buy 50 movies, at least 50 movies for our afternoon movie channel, and we've been offered 200. Somebody's got to run those 200 movies and pick 50. That was my job. And they were all like Hollywood independents. They weren't studio pictures. So they'd been shot, most of them, on the streets of L.A. And, oh, man, that was film school, because we didn't have one film course at Carnegie Tech, not one. So my thing was seeing 200 movies.
Wow.
And boy, I could see from the independents where the lights were, because it was all hot. You could tell. But I could see setups. I could see how they do it. And so I fell in love with indie movies and L.A. at the same time, right? L.A., oh, this was 1954, going into 54, 55. And I ran all the movies, told them the 50 to buy. And then I said, gee, I'd love to make something. He said, well, the only thing we got is we have public service announcements for different government departments, because CBC was government. So the first shooting I ever did was how to put out your campfire. So they threw me up to north of Toronto to what's called Cottage Country, and we went on a campsite and shot and came back. And then all of the editors who were editing this at CBC were all mad at me. They said, we're all waiting for a break, and you're not even an editor, and you got to direct. I then started writing, and I thought, okay, I'm going to write a movie, and I did about a personal experience, A Dangerous Age. I actually sold it to CBC as a television drama. You know, changed it around so they could shoot it. It was a live show, and they did that, and it got my confidence going. Actors were saying my dialogue, and it sounded normal. Then I raised about $25,000, $29,000 to be exact, and I knew I'd met someone who knew how to shoot film, and he knew a sound guy, and like they do movies today, four of us went out and made A Dangerous Age. It was shot in 10 days, and it was 35mm film, an Aeroflex, and it sold in the States. Somebody bought it. I don't know where it ever played. It played in England in an art house and got rave reviews that it, believe me, it did not deserve. The headline was only 24 when I made it, but what a filmmaker. It was primitive. I didn't even know that when two people are looking at each other and each have a close-up, one looks to the right and one looks to the left. I have people looking in the same direction because I hadn't been to film school, right? But I learned in editing all about that. I learned right from doing it. And then what was so interesting is that film, which would have been lost, for some reason, Government of Canada, their film archives, picked it up, preserved it, and exhibited it. And when recently, for Daniel, I needed a copy, they could send me one. My second film, which I made in Toronto the next year, A Cool Sound from Hell, there isn't an existing print copy, anything, except British Film Institute has a negative, and they think a magnetic track, and Daniel hunted it down, and we're hoping they're going to make us a copy. I told Daniel, I don't want to see it. You can review it. Another 10-day wonder, which costs twice as much, so I learned something about filmmaking, right?
Right.
The cost goes up.
You made quite a string of films in England. How did you manage that kind of jump across the pond?
My theory, which I think was good, was that if I went to Hollywood, how the hell could I break in? I already had seen 200 indie movies, and I knew it was crowded down here. The fact you'd made a movie was no big deal. But England, because then Canadians were considered British subjects, we could go to England, we could vote, we could work, no work permit, nothing. And I said, and I'd written a script, and a producer in New York said, let's make it in London. I said, great. He gave me a ticket. And then I never saw him again for the rest of my life. He never showed up. But I was there, right? I was ready to go home, and this was pretty funny. I was ready to go home, and about 2 days before, I had a family with me. My assistant director, who was English, British, Cockney, who had been in Toronto on my second film. He was at Pinewood at the bar, and he's talking to some production manager who was producing a movie for an American and said, geez, I can't find a director. I've got 3,500 pounds, which was, what, about 5,000 in my budget. And the AD said, I got a guy who'll do it for 1,500. I said, great. I got the job, just like that. It was crazy. And that was the famous Dr. Blood's Coffin. It was in color, and we went on location in Cornwall, which is right at the tip of England, nearest point to the United States. And it had, I don't remember, I think it was 15 days, so that was a luxury. And that's how it happened, you know, it's that crazy thing.
I was curious about the shooting of the Ypres File. I mean, it's such a amazing film. What kind of memories do you have about that one?
Only good ones. I can remember every day. Isn't that wild? There are certain things you don't forget, and here's why. When I got the Harry Saltzman asked me to do the Ypres File, he had seen The Leather Boys, which was very much in the style of his Woodfall pictures. You know, he was the backer of Tony Richardson and Carol Rice, Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, Taste of Honey. And he had seen that, and he came to me, and I read the script, and honestly, it was god-awful. It was horrible, horrible. But he told me it had Michael Caine, and I knew Michael from a restaurant that we all went to. And he was always with Terrence Stamp and people. They were young. They were always laughing. And they had beautiful women with them, or girls, I guess, right? And I sort of hated them. And I remember I'd always get drunk and say, I want to punch that guy in the face, right? And when I met him, I said, look, before we start, Michael, I used to see you at the White Elephant, and I really wanted to take it, you know, slug you. And that started us knowing, Michael, that's the best thing you could have said. The worst would have been, I've always admired your work, right? And so I said, so tell me, what do you think of the script? He said, it's a load of codswallop. I remember the word. That's a very East End British expression, like it's a load of shit, right? I said, what are we going to do? He says, you know, we gotta give it ambiance. And he did use the French word. We have to give it a feel. And we got to get it rewritten. So we went to Harry and said, we need a writer. Because I think the script we read had been written by a director from a book that didn't give the hero a name. It was moody, very moody, the book, Len Dayton's book. But it didn't have a narrative, right? Not really. So we got a couple things. We got a writer, and we got the guy who had put up the money for the book for Harry, a guy named Charles Tasher, an interesting guy, knew nothing about movies, but like so many of those guys, they're so wise, so wise. And he had sold on television Charles Antel Formula 7. You've never seen a bald sheep, so if you use this lanolin in your head, it'll grow hair. It was very famous in the 50s. And he just had a natural instinct for storytelling. And we were a brains trust. And we worked on the script and worked. And then someone else came in. And this was all before shooting. And then in shooting, writing was still going on. So we shot the movie in, I'd say, direct continuity. I don't know what word you'd use. But scene one was 1, 2, 3. In order. We shot it in order because we knew we were changing as we went. And as we would see things each day, oh, yeah, we should do this with the characters. So it was the most creative experience I have ever had in my entire life. And Michael is the greatest actor. There are no bad stories about Michael Caine. He is, every director who's ever worked with him says the same. He comes to work, he's funny, he makes jokes. The other actors can't complain because Michael's happy. And it was one of those great experiences. Of course, I did not get on with Harry Saltzman, which is in every book or anyone has ever written. And that's okay, because you need someone to hate in a movie. You really need someone. You got to have one prick that everybody knows is a prick. So you work harder to show him, right? So you're always under the gun. He's He's never happy. And Peter Hunt, the great editor who was going to edit it, was away for the first 2 weeks. And there was no editing. And Harry said, when Peter comes back, I'm going to show him the footage. He used to tell me. And if he doesn't like it, you're canned, right? He was that kind of guy, you know, easier, better than a sneaky guy, right? You know, a villain is easy to deal with, right? Really easy. So Peter came back. I remember it was a Saturday. I was sitting at home or whatever. And the first call I got was from Peter. And Peter said, Sidney, I want to tell you what I've just said to Harry. And Peter was out. He was gay and out in that era. That's why what he's going to say was cute. He said, Harry, you don't fire Sidney Fury. Go up there and give him a big wet kiss. And that was it. From then on, Harry complained, but he could do nothing because Peter loved it. And it was the only picture I've ever done, ever, that I was never in the cutting room while cutting was going on. Never. Isn't that funny? Remember, once we had a screening, and some guy at the screening would get titles, and he and I didn't get on. I don't remember why. Oh, I think he wanted to direct me, of course, Flowers. I mean, he says, what a piece of shit. And he left the screening room, and everyone else in the room said, this is a very unique, good movie. And they had an idea to switch some scenes. I don't remember what they were, a structure thing. And that was it. I mean, it was like, no matter what we did. Oh, and I hated the whole end sequence. I said that belongs in a Bond film. It does not belong. It was Harry's idea when he's in the box and all that. But he had built the set at Pinewood, and he said, there's no way we're not shooting it. But we made it work. You know, it gave it a bit of a climax. So, you know, the thing of him coming out and he was in London all the time seemed to work. So I also learned in that picture, don't always go by your own taste. You know, you can't. You got to go sometimes with the quote-unquote committee of filmmakers or artistic people, you know.
Right, right. You were talking about how you have to have one prick on the set when it comes to this stuff. Who was the prick on the Appaloosa?
Wasn't anyone on the set. It was the studio, whoever the studio was, okay? And so I'm trying to remember, because I've never been asked that question. So I'll tell you what I think it was. I think it was the head production manager who had incredible power, right? Not even the head of production, but there was a physical guy who dealt with the crews and dealt with your schedule. And it would be like an executive production manager, whatever he was called, right? And nothing wrong with the guy. You know, he was a decent man. But they had a way of doing things. So, example, this was 1965 in Hollywood. I'd already, in 1957 and 8, used an Aeroflex for a full movie. The Aeroflex was locked up in a camera car. On the set were these big Mitchells. We're out in Utah doing a Western. I said, I want the area, I want the guy on a horse, and I want the cameraman operator, if he's willing, if not whoever's willing, to sit and get that kind of shot over the shoulder of Brando or the double, right? And they had to call Hollywood to get permission to bring out the Aeroflex. The old-fashionedness of that was the thing that drove it. But if you thought I was going to say Brando, not true. Brando was difficult, but for other reasons. Brando was a great person, and a good human being. He was that little boy who never quite grew up. In other words, all the good characters that a young kid would have. His problem is he hated Universal, and he was only doing this to get rid of a contract. So I was caught in the middle of that. So, you know, we had our fights, but the fact you could fight with him and he wouldn't storm off the set or say, get rid of this director or I don't come back out. You know, I was smart enough to know what his problem was, but it was in the shooting aspect of it. It was very, very difficult. And Russ Metty, who was an artist, a film artist, he had, you know, did pictures with Orson Welles and others. He was really a Hollywood product. He didn't like young upstart directors, right? And he would, in effect, say so. And he thought all scenes should be shot on a soundstage, including day scenes. Well, we did shoot some night scenes on there. That whole approach. We never got the script right, but that's not their problem. It was just not to be. We sure fought hard. And that's where I learned after Ipcress, just because you have a writer and you're working and working and working, or we had more than one writer, one quit in the middle of the night, Jim Bridges, I don't blame him. Just because you work hard doesn't mean you succeed. So it was a lesson, you know. It's part of a career and part of a thing. I was still in my creative artistic mode, which critically they broke me of, right? In other words, if people don't want things that are different, they'll accept difference if it's a popular film. But if it isn't, they'll use that as an excuse to get you. And I felt that style from my heart, you know? Not that I ever was a painter, but I just felt composition was what movies could be about. They certainly were in many cases with John Ford. Not as extreme as me, I know, but I enjoyed Appaloosa, but it was a different, the studio system is something completely different. You can't even explain it, and that's when it was good. That's when it was really good. That's the joke. Now it's a tentpole industry today.
So a few years after the Appaloosa, you made Lady Sings the Blues. How was that project?
That was similar in many ways to how Ipcress came about. Very, very similar. It had a script that a producer, Jay Weston, brought to me. Not a very good script, but nicely written. And I said, I think it's gone in the wrong direction. Let's get this writer and try to make it better. And he brought the guy in and paid him a few bucks, and we worked on it. Then he had talked about an actress called Diana Sands, and I said, no, she's not a singer. You need a singer who acts. And I've recently seen a variety show with Diana Ross acting, comedy. I said, she's great. He saw the show, Kinescope, and said, well, she didn't do anything dramatic. I said, the comedy is tougher than the drama. She can act. Okay, he said, okay, let's get this done. And he went to see Barry Gordy, who controlled her in many ways. He loved the idea. So we thought we had a pretty good script. And then he said, no, this is what's wrong. And then we'd have meetings. And I had written with Terrence McCoy that first script, after his first script, the rewrite. And then a lot of people came in and wrote different scenes and things. And finally, we got it together. Wasn't right yet. Once again, I did the old thing, let's shoot it in sequence. So if we have a great idea and writing is still going on, because the best writing goes on when you know the characters and they're acting. And you say, like, we brought in Richard Pryor for one day to be this piano guy. So writing, like on Ipcress, continued daily, except I did a lot of improvisation, a lot. And some of the best scenes between her and Billy were improvised. But it followed the same thing. And while I love Barry Gordy, he took the role of, not prick, because not, but I don't know, the right word would be the guy who said, we've got to work harder, harder, harder. So he became the trainer and Karate Kid. Make it better, make it better, make it better. So he wasn't a villain, okay? Because the taskmaster on Ipcress was Charles Cashin. And there was no real villain on Lady at all, except we wanted it to be good. And Barry was the guy that pushed us, and pushed Diana, who we knew well. It followed a similar pattern, very similar pattern. When it was first seen, Peter Bart, who was then next to Evans, head of production, Peter went on to Variety, you know who he is, and he screened it when we thought we were done. We didn't do much after. He said, he walked out, Barry Gordy and I were waiting in the outer room. He said, Barry, you just ruined Diana's career. It's when they walk out and say, this is great, going to do 100 mil, you're in trouble. So that was Lady.
I imagine that you had a pretty good time with Billy Dee and Ann Richards since they went on to your next project.
That's correct. I had great relationship with both. They worked completely different, but they were actors to me, performers, you know, in the case. That picture, I hadn't even seen something the opposite, right, to Lady. So, of course, we were all affected by French Connection and Marseille and all that. So I had an idea and then got Alan Trustman in, who had written Bullet or co-wrote, and Thomas Crown Affair. And then when it time to cast it, I just worked with Billy. I just thought he was a good leading man. He's handsome. He's good. And there was a part. And in that day, you could, that whole movie shows you the difference. We shot in Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, California, north of Seattle, Washington, and in Marseille, France. Four places to move around. The whole movie cost $1.6 million. You couldn't even do that. There's no price. You couldn't. It's too cumbersome how they do it today. Indies could do it for 50 Gs. You know, but that's, it's different. But he basically said the dialogue and the script, and in a few places he improvised, tiny, but controlled improvisation. The rehearsal, nothing when the camera was going. I think he sang a song at one point as he's driving to do with a boat. He made up a little ditty, yeah. But basically, he stuck to everything, and it was, it's funny because I hadn't seen it since it was made. And Daniel said, you know, I've just run Hit. There's a Blu-ray, and I really like it. Why don't you ever talk about it? I said, the Hollywood syndrome, it wasn't successful. That's how they get you here. He said, you better run it. And I ran it. And I got to tell you, I enjoyed it. I said, wow, this is interesting, you know? And remember, of course, it comes back to you, but it was fresh to me. So I said to Daniel, if nothing else happens out of the book, knowing you, I went back to see this. And it's happened on a couple of other movies where he said, you better see it. And say, hey, okay, yeah, not commercial, not successful, but at this point, it doesn't matter, right?
I was curious, it's such a diverse cast. What was it like working with so many different types of actors?
Well, it was wonderful because there wasn't a set picture. Once again, it was shot almost in sequence, not quite. I don't remember. We may have started in L.A. And then I don't think so. I don't remember. But because it was about different kinds of people and they were different, it was, I remember thinking, this is fun, you know, this is working, this is real. When you're into it all, you just do it. I think there was a tiny bit of friction between Billy, who's very straight, who, no secret, was on drugs, right? I don't know what it was. I guess it was heroin. Was it coke, I guess? Coke, I don't know. But he never knew on the set he indulged, ever. Always on time, a gentleman, no problem. Very good person. So I think Billy and him had their problems, but I only learned about this years later. I didn't know. But Marseille was a great city. We loved Marseille. And an ugly city. Nothing beautiful about Marseille. But it had a feel. And I took high school French, so I could use a few words, right?
What was it like working with Gwen Wells?
Well, Gwen, what she was. I mean, I don't say she was a drug addict, but I'm sure she was on drugs. But it was real. You know, she was just what she was playing herself. And but that was just her in real life. That wasn't acting. That was just how she talked and what she was. The whole point. She had a short life. Huh? Boy. Yeah. Yeah.
Can I ask you about what it's been like making the Iron Eagle films?
The first one, we shot half of it here, and then we went to Israel and finished it with certain scenes done in Israel here because we couldn't get the Air Force to approve us here. That's why we went there, to get those F-16s. And that was an era right before CGI, right? All those were real planes, as all the planes in Top Gun were real. After that, there were no real planes. They were all CGI planes. So we actually had a unit up in the air shooting planes. And, you know, it's just a kid adventure. And when you go to, when I went to the screenings and theaters, and it appealed to young boys and their fathers. It was fun. It was great. You know, after Lady and after Chris and other things and the Entity, all kinds of things. It was fun to have a rip-roaring adventure film. And the second one continued that way, but we kind of milked it dry by the fourth. But I enjoyed it. If you look at my career, it's very diverse, you know? Didn't want to type myself because that's me. I love movies. I love all kinds of movies, you know? And right now, I'm writing one that's basically a comedy, an interesting little movie that I'm hoping to make for $100,000 or four or five, right? The way kids make movies today.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Daniel's been very encouraging. With digital, there's no reason not, you know? I haven't written in years. I functioned as a writer by acting out scenes, and they would write them up. But this one came from my gut, and I just said, I want to do it. And I found that the writing was more fun than the directing, unfortunately. Because in the writing, you're on your own. And there's no one to say different until they read it. But it's a totally creative thing. It has to be a nightmare if you're doing it for someone else who comes back with notes and demands it be done. I get notes from various people, but I decide what I like in the notes and what I don't. So that's different, completely different. A lot of times people give you notes and don't understand the acting, the tone of the movie, certain things or whatever, or you can't. So I think the life of a professional screenwriter is horrendous. It's just got to be the worst.
I've got one more for you. I was curious where you're at with Pride of Lions.
Oh, it's finished, and it'll be coming out, I think, in about 2 or 3 months. It's doing that new release thing. You open in a theater, and then you're on VOD, and then afterwards DVD.
Flame is strong, 'cause we may not be the young ones very long.
Thanks to Sidney Fury for taking the time to talk to us and talking about his career, you know, all the various films that he's done and other terrific work. Now, Daniel, I know that you've been working on a book project on Mr. Fury and his work, and was just wondering if you could tell us about the book and how long you've been working on it.
Sure. I actually started the book. My first introduction to Sidney Fury as a name was through a little ditty called Superman IV, The Quest for Peace, when I was a wee lad. And even back then, I noticed the names of directors early on. It's, I was a film nerd from the get-go, in a sense. So I was like, and back then, I thought that the original, you know, Superman films, I thought all of them were fantastic films, and I liked four back then. If you look at it, and I have a soft spot for it still. My brothers and I joke that Mark Pillow, who plays Nuclear Man at the altar of his own wedding, would say, "Where is the woman?" To kind of quote Nuclear Man. But we were raised on those films, and eventually, when I was 11 years old, my kind of after school activity was sat perched in front of the television watching Bravo and Encore. Bravo, as it was before the advent of reality TV, and now you can't get anything on Bravo in terms of old films. But I remember seeing The Luck of Ginger Coffee, the Beaufort's Gun, Charlie Bubbles with Albert Finney, and a bunch of really esoteric films. Kind of probably the birth of my love of esoteric cinema. But around that time, I saw Icarus File when I was 11 years old. And it was probably one of the four films I saw from a very young age that really left this indelible impression on me and made me consider film as a career versus a hobby. And keep in mind, I was seeing Icarus File again, pan and scan, and I was missing a lot of the picture, but it's still the mood of the piece and the kind of the way that it, I don't know, the way the whole film just kind of operated just really cast a total spell over me. I got the movie as a birthday present when I was 12, I think. In the interim, I saw, other films by him, including Lady Sings the Blues and an old Paramount 2 VHS set and other films by him, including Hugh Levine on that old crappy 80s television transfer, the old taping off the TV of that film. And I saw Icarus File again when I was in my early 20s, when I first moved to New York, so it would have been about 5 years ago. I got the Region 2 disc, which has all the extra features and had the commentary track with Sydney. It had all the extra features, and it was my first time seeing it in widescreen. I mean, it was crazy because I was being blown away by it all over again. I was blown away the first time seeing it kind of compromised, and I was blown away all over again seeing just how intensely unusual, particularly for 1964 when it was shot and 65 when it came out, just how much he went out on a limb in terms of the kind of visual component. And the film was the front runner to win at Cannes that year, even though it was beat out by Richard Lester's The Knack and How to Get It. It was one of the two official British invites, which also included Lumet's The Hill. The Knack was its special invite, but just considering the fact that, you know, usually this is like a espionage title. It's usually Harry Saltzman, who produced the James Bond movies, produced the Harry Palmer series as what he thought was going to be the poor man's Bond, and wound up being the anti-Bond, thankfully. But it's very unusual that a genre exercise and within the spy realm was this kind of prized film within the kind of art house community and at Cannes. It was there's a quote by Gabier, who was the French author, who thought that the jury made a horrendous decision to award The Knack that year. But then watching other films of his in widescreen, and then doing kind of marathon, where I was realizing that there are thematic threads to all these films. There's a kind of visual thread to all these films. He's no bones about it. To me, he was an auteur, and there was a total lack of anything written about him. And I was like, oh, wouldn't it be great if someone wrote a book about him and his career and his work and everything, a monograph or a formal biography, whatever. And I was like, well, man, I can do an article, an article would be good. I have time to write. I have time to do that. And so I wrote this kind of academic treatise, 20 some pages on the blog. And thanks to Margot Kidder, actually, who was on his last film, Pride of Lions, she saw the article somehow and said, hey, you know, Sydney, some guy wrote this thing about you. You should check it out. And he's like, no, I don't need anything like that. Eventually, he read it. He told me in a truck stop on the way to a location to shoot one day, and I guess liked the writing a great deal. And Paul Lynch, who is his best friend, has been for a few decades, met with him for lunch and said, you know, everyone has a book. You don't contact this guy. Go out and find him. And you know, it's like you owe yourself. You owe your grandkids. You owe your all your family. You know, do something with it. So we got in touch with each other, and we've had this kind of amazing friendship as well as a kind of camaraderie with writing the book, which has been really rewarding. There's probably not a day that goes by where we don't touch base with each other, but I got to writing, and he came to New York twice. I went out to LA three times, and we were, you know, recording, and I was gathering all these other interviews to people with whom we worked throughout all these decades. Paul Lynch, over lunch one day, he was like the kind of keeper of Sydney's records, because he's very proud of the fact that he keeps nothing in terms of memorabilia. He said, if my house is burning down, I take my wife and my tax records. Paul was kind of handed over all that he had saved for, as like, you know, Sydney's proxy memory keeper. And he goes, what do you plan on doing with this once you're done? I was like, I don't know, I'll shop it around, find something somewhere. I was like, well, I worked on a book about Raoul Walsh written by a woman named Marilyn Moss, and she got it published through Screen Classics. And if you want, I can put you in touch with Pat McGilligan, who runs the press. And I was like, that would be great, because my model for this whole thing was what Nick Dawson did with the Hal Ashby book years ago in 2009. And when I was first getting into Fury hot and heavy, I was like, you know, wouldn't it be great if someone did a book like Dawson's except for Fury? So it was great that the exact same press, I was going to get in touch with the guy who ran that, and it was going to be the same kind of, you know, written under the same conditions, the same, you know, kind of aegis, you know, auspices. And so Pat was very supportive, you know, from the get-go, and he kind of think it's a great idea, write me, you know, a proposal, and we did all that stuff, and the press, which has also been very helpful, picked it up, and we're working away on it. So it's been a very, very rewarding time. And it's also been great just talking to the people and the collaborators with whom he's worked over the years. You know, the book is just chock full of interviews with a lot of people that a lot of stars and people that, you know, readers would know. You know, it's been great.
So where are you at with the project? Are you first draft done, or what's the timeline for you?
Well, the first draft is due on May 15th. You know, up until then, I'll be kind of working under that deadline. So I'm currently, I just scored an interview recently with Rick Natkin, who is the writer of Boys and Company C and Purple Hearts and, you know, a couple other films that Cindy had a hand in. So that filled in some gaps on Boys and Company C. So I've just been kind of continuing to locate people to get them to talk about what it was like to work with him. Everyone has some outrageous kind of story about having worked with him. He's just kind of you probably picked it up from your conversation with him. He's a real bundle of energy, and pretty much has been in his entire career. He's, like I said, he's this element of kind of a lot of dangerousness about him, where you don't know often what he's going to do or what he's going to say next. Even though everyone has loved working with him, and a lot of the people, he has an entourage kind of people who have worked with him over and over again. So it's kind of like, watching a Fury film is like watching, watching a Woody Allen movie and seeing, like, you know, certain names like Santa Laquasto or whatever, you know, people whose names you see over and over again in the credits. So he's kept a lot of the same people throughout the years as crew members and as cast members. So, just the sheer number of stories that I picked up from them and also from Cindy himself, whether it's about working with Marlon Brando or working with Frank Sinatra or Robert Redford or any of these guys, that he's, you know, it's a long and illustrious career of with a lot of names that that he's had the pleasure and privilege of working with, and vice versa. But that, and just, you know, writing in a kind of analytical and historical sense about a man's work and putting the kind of puzzle pieces together has been rewarding. Seeing, because I they're one of three major themes that kind of emerge with each film, at least each of the major films in that bulk of his career. And also just catching a director who's worked within Canadian independent cinema at its earliest outset, you know, in the late 1950s, when there was no Canadian film industry whatsoever. British New Wave, kind of the tail end, the fall of the studio system, the beginning of the new Hollywood, which I think Fawcett Halsey is an example of that type of an effort. Going into kind of 80s blockbusters with Iron Eagle, then going into the kind of direct-to-video market. It's been a really fantastic and a really out-there career in that, you know, you look at Leather Boys or any of the kind of kitchen sink dramas he made in England, and then you look at, like, Ladybugs, or you look at, like, Iron Eagle, whatever, you know, whatever one you want. Or any of the films he's made from the 90s onwards. Like, did the same director do both of these movies? How is that possible? And at the same time, you notice a couple things. But yeah, just the kind of the evolution he's undergone since the earliest parts of his career has been really fascinating to capture the kind of dualities of, like, you know, him as a kind of A-list director in the 70s after Lady Sings the Blues, which is a tremendous box office and critical hit. He was a real A-lister for a time, and ultimately shot down by a couple movies that didn't do so well. But yeah, just kind of capturing that the evolution he's undergone in the time that he's been working has been really, really fascinating. As a writer who's capturing it, it's really, really amazing.
I have to say, when I posted that we were going to be talking to Sydney on the Facebook group, the one film that really got a lot of attention was The Entity, which I have not yet seen. Yeah.
a couple entity things that happened to me personally. Is that I was at Lincoln Center last year. I forget what I was catching. I think it was Just a Gigolo on a print, the David Bowie German movie. There were guys next to me in the audience, and they were talking about, they were talking about directors and the fact that Altman's Nashville is coming out. Like, oh, what about Sidney Fury? I couldn't believe my ears that the people were talking about, Sidney Fury next to me. And, it's like, oh yeah, the entity, they should bring the entity back again. And after a while, they were talking about it so much that I couldn't resist, and saying like, hey, I'm writing a book about Sidney Fury. And actually, it's one of the guys had read the original article I posted about Sidney's films, my blog. So I was like, you're the guy. Like, oh, yeah, you read. That's great. So it's funny when these things happen. But then after that screening, Gavin Smith, who runs Film Comment, was there. And I was saying, like, Lincoln Center should do a retrospective of his work. And the first thing he said, well, the entity is a masterpiece. And he didn't even say, like, oh, yeah, Sidney Fury. He didn't. The first thing he said was, entity is a masterpiece. And I was really struck by how direct that comment was. That the first thing he thought of when I said the name was the entity. But it's really is a highly regarded. If you've seen Martin Scorsese named the entity as the fourth best horror film of all time, he had a list of 11, and the entity was number four, I believe, and placed it, I guess, above The Shining and what was the other outrage? Oh yeah, and above Psycho, which is really saying something. It's a really I keep on using this word, but it's the only word I can think of is ballsy. There's a lot of gumption to shoot that film the way that it's shot, the kind of stylization of that film, and the kind of it's easy to take that film in the wrong direction with a plot, synopsis like that. Oh yeah, a woman is raped by a ghost over and over again. That's hard to make that delicate. But what makes the film really interesting is that as a director, and Barbara Hershey's performance is amazing, and he makes her just a very strong, sympathetic character, and also the men in the film are kind of uniformly creepy. So you have this kind of strong central female character, and surrounded by these kind of these men who are many of them are kind of up to no good, or they're kind of working against getting her help, as opposed to just thinking it's all in her head. So it's a very, very fascinating film, I think. So I highly recommend it. And I think a lot of people believe that's his best film outside of Chris File and Poison Company C.
Yeah, that was one of many films. Rob, you talk about how Cinema Detours gave you a lot of movies to check out. That was one of those where I was reading Kayla Janice's book, and it was like, oh, geez, another movie that I have to see, because she wrote a lot about that, a lot about Shulowski's Possession. So it's like, okay, a lot of these things moved right to the top of my need to track this down list. And I have sadly not yet tracked down the entity, but based on that and based on this conversation, I will be doing that very soon. We're going to take another break and play a preview from next week's show.
I want a show that will make headlines. The Huxtables, Cosby, a genius, revolutionary, but we can't go down that road again.
The network does not want to see Negroes on television unless they are buffoons.
Have you ever thought about just quitting?
I have a contract. The only way I get out of that is if I get fired, and that is what I intend to do.
I know you are familiar with minstrel shows, variety shows, like In Living Color.
Right, right, right. That was dope.
Man Tan. The new Millennium Minstrel Show.
We're going to need a little more money for this.
This could be bigger than Friends, Ally McBeal, even my boys Amos and Andy.
Damn. You're putting white actors in blackface?
We're using black actors with blacker faces.
Hollywood. Run.
This fall.
Right on, man.
Yeah, great show.
You won't believe what's coming to your television.
Sleep and Eat and Man Tan are lazy and unemployed.
Do your stuff.
But we are certainly not saying anything about the entire African-American community.
What's sweeping the nation? And what's coloring?
Oh,
the way you see the world.
Yo, we can't let this injustice go by, man. Not this time, man.
You know what I'm saying?
Nah, man. You know what I'm saying?
You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying?
You notice that everybody white wanna be black.
How about raising up?
They all act like sound left.
When are you gonna come into the light?
The light.
The light.
Your hands are just as bloody as mine.
Cousins, I want you all to go to your windows. We talking about revolution. Go to your windows and yell out, I am not gonna take it anymore.
I don't want anything to do with anything black for at least a week.
That's right, we're back, and we're talking about Spike Lee's controversial film about race in the media, Bamboozled. We'll be joined by my good friend, J. Scott Smith, and he'll join us in the booth for the first time, so treat him well, and to discuss the film as part of our celebration of Black History Month as it continues, so you do not want to miss that one. But before we go, we want to thank this week's special guest host, Daniel Kramer. Dan, you know, we've talked about the book and everything that you've been working on. What's the best place for people to go to keep up with your work and basically everything you do?
The blog, which I haven't written on at all, really, since the book got started. So, you know, you're not going to find anything new there. But confluencefilm.com, confluencefilm.com. I make films as well. That's kind of, you know, that's where I'm coming from. But I also write a great deal about ephemeral films and esoteric films and films that are really under the radar. Like I said, I haven't written on it in well over a year at this point because I've been really preoccupied by, you know, working on the book. But yeah, that's where to keep up with everything, including my actual filmmaking work as well as the film scholarship work.
Well, very cool. We will be sure to link over to that over at our website, projection-booth.com. So I want to thank you again, Daniel, for coming on the show. And I want to thank everyone for taking the time to listen. So feel free to pay it forward by spreading the word about the Projection Booth and all the good stuff that we're doing here. Stay cool.
Billy Dee Williams. Now, you and your family can relive all of the excitement with the Mel Gibson Commemorative Grant Plate Collection. Order now. And each month you'll receive a beautiful hand-fired plate featuring one of Mel's most outrageous outbursts, including, you offend my masculinity, my being, my soul. And you call me a sinner? You're a moving violation. Or how about, your logic sucks because you are a mentally deprived idiot. And the classic, I deserve to be first before the jacuzzi. I'll burn the house down, but me first. Each plate is made of 100% unbreakable polycarbonate, perfect for hurling at your loved ones again and again. Bitch. Order now, and we'll throw in a free Oxana collagen lip foam so you can record your own private conversations. So what are you waiting for? You stupid pieces of...